I next met with Dr. Matthew Smith, and to begin, I asked him about recent developments in the use of androgen receptor antagonists for patients with M0 castrate-resistant disease.
I think in the recent past, there have been a lot of misunderstandings about this disease state called non-metastatic CRPC. And part of that was this idea that it was a very indolent disease and that patients were at relatively low risk for progression or death from prostate cancer. But, you know, a variety of analyses of previous prospective studies showed that that really is not the case, particularly for patients with unfavorable PSA kinetics or, in fact, at high risk for progression and death from prostate cancer. And then in the last couple of years, we've had these now three randomized controlled trials reported that potent endocrine agents, apalutamide, enzalutamide, and now darolutamide, meaningfully improve metastasis-free survival with, you know, large treatment effects of with improvements of about 2 years with each of those agents.
And hazard rates around 0.5.
Actually, even better than that, sort of 0.3 to 0.4, depending on which study. So really big improvements. And in a way, the surprising observation was even though the survival data for each of those trials is immature to date, there's at least strong trends in favor of better overall survival with early intervention. I think that, in many ways, has exceeded even the most optimistic clinicians' expectations. So we look forward to longer follow-up in those trials, but certainly the totality of evidence really supports early intervention in that setting.
Before you talk a little bit about sort of the differences in the trials in these agents, a little bit more in terms of your comment about sort of the prognosis of patients with M0 disease and identifying, you know, sort of different subsets between those. And it's interesting that, you know, you're starting to see the survival advantage, which also implies that maybe the control arm didn't do that well.
I think that's right. I mean, that's one of the important takeaways from all of these trials. So in each of the three trials, the three pivotal studies, Spartan, Prosper, and Aramis reported at the meeting, they included patients at higher risk for progression based on a PSA doubling time at entry of less than 10 months. And that corresponds to about the top half of risk. 10 months is about the median PSA doubling time for patients with non-metastatic CRPC. So each of those trials included patients at somewhat higher risk for progression.
One of the things that came out of the symposium was the fact, which I thought was a little interesting, you know, usually people look at the global entry criteria of your trial, which, as you say, was 10 months. But I remember it might have been Oliver Sartor commented, well, there was a gradation. The median was maybe 6 months of the patients who actually got in the trial.
Yeah, even a little shorter. The median each of the trials was between 4 and 5 months.
So the other thing is maybe easier to see if you're doing GU cancer research all the time, but from a more macro perspective, when you look at this, is that this is not M0 disease untreated. This is M0 disease that's progressing on androgen deprivation.
That's exactly right.
And so once you get into that arena of people who clearly are, you know, maybe their PSA doubling time is either high or low, but the point is the PSA is going up while they're on androgen deprivation. Globally, what's the chance of metastatic disease, like say over the next 3 years?
It's very high. So the median time to metastasis or death in each of these trials was sort of in the 16 to 18 month range. And so if you consider it a 3 year landmark, you're looking at, you know, something like 3/4 of the patients without intervention would develop metastasis or die from prostate cancer.
You know, one thing I was trying to get into at that symposium, I'm not sure how you all responded to it. Our perspective doing CME, you know, for general oncology is the contrast in this situation to other situations oncologists deal with, notably particularly breast cancer, where there's a lot of granularity to numbers. People know, you know, if you have two positive nodes, HER2, whatever, kind of what to expect. I'm not sure people have as clearly ingrained kind of how to look at the prognosis of not only M0 disease, I'm not even sure about metastatic disease, but particularly M0 disease.
Yeah, I think the difference there, Neil, maybe that, you know, in prostate cancer, PSA is uniformly expressed. And as a time-dependent variable, it really does have a high predictive value. And so it kind of overcomes most of the other baseline characteristics that might be considered. And in prior analysis that we and others have conducted, it's really, you know, PSA kinetics that stands out as predicting risk for progression or death. And so I think that because it's a singular variable, there's probably less use of models or predictive tools for progression.
So just to, you know, maybe kind of tease this out a little bit, because I really can imagine, and I try to put myself in the place of an oncologist listening or watching this, you know, you might have a situation, maybe you can describe a classic or common clinical situation where you have a patient who now is progressing on androgen deprivation. I guess it could be after a long time or different periods of time, but they are definitely progressing. So in a patient like that, if you just continue an LHRH agonist, what kind of numbers would you be thinking about in terms of the chance of having clinical metastatic disease over the next few years based on the doubling time?
We know from these trials that a patient with a doubling time, say, of 4 to 6 months, which would be a bit faster than the average patient, but a typical patient in these trials, the median time to detectable metastases by conventional imaging, bone scan, CT, so I think a fair reference to your term clinical progression, the median time is about 16 or 18 months, so relatively short. And there is a graded effect, so the faster the PSA doubling time, the shorter to that outcome, and the longer the PSA doubling time, the more indolent the disease.
So, I mean, in a way, you are sort of treating a number. I mean, the patient's asymptomatic, but, you know, given the tolerability issues involved or the risks involved, in what kind of situation would you say you have clear-cut progression on androgen deprivation where you would say, I'll just follow the patient, I won't add anything to it because the PSA doubling time is very low? How low would it have to be?
Sure. So much like other clinical situations, we're always trying to, you know, consider risk-benefit. So a patient who I'd be more willing to observe would be an older patient with comorbidities, such that I'm more concerned about the side effects of treatment, even for drugs that we would otherwise characterize as generally well-tolerated, and who is also at lower risk for cancer progression based on a slower rate of PSA rise. So, you know, a patient who, you know, 85-year-old man with a doubling time of a year and an absolute value of PSA of 5 and recent imaging that was normal, I'd likely follow for a while, but only after having the conversation that, you know, we think you'll need treatment in the future. We could do that now. Here's the reasons we could consider that. Here are the downsides. And then really want to hear his view, his preferences for care before we make a final decision.
So I keep trying to figure out how to, I don't know, get some numbers on some of these situations. I know there aren't perfect numbers, but just to give more of a feel about how to advise patients, we actually asked the faculty in our survey, what's the most important factor? We know it's, well, it's PSA doubling time, but what other factors? And people always bring up absolute PSA level. So, like, how do you factor the speed of development? You know, how quickly, I guess mainly the PSA is doubling. But how do you factor in how many months it's been total that this has been developing? But how do you factor in absolute benefit? And what level changes? Is it 10 or 20? How do you look at that?
Change in PSA value?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, all the studies included patients with a PSA of at least 2. So, you know, if you start talking about a patient with castrate-resistant disease based on a PSA that goes from 0.1 to 0.2 to 0.3, that may, in fact, biologically represent castration-resistant disease. But we could probably readily acknowledge that they're at comparatively low risk for progression because this is a very early part of that transition.
I never thought about that range. I mean, can you actually see that evolve clinically?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So many patients who are treated with ADT without detectable metastases will achieve an undetectable PSA as their nadir value. And so you'll see this PSA rising in a very low range as an early indication of transition to castration-resistant disease. But no such patients were included in these pivotal trials. They had to have a PSA of at least 2, and
wow,
the median PSA was something in the range of, let's call it 8 or 10 in each of the trials. So that's kind of the population we're looking at. So, you know, you do have an opportunity to observe patients to really get a better appreciation of the PSA kinetics and come to understand their preferences for care in many cases. But if I'm seeing a new patient, meaning for the first time, second opinion, who's, you know, had recent imaging and no detectable metastases and a PSA doubling time of 11 months, it would make a difference to know whether his PSA was 5 or 50 in terms of my enthusiasm for intervention or, for that matter, enthusiasm for doing further imaging.
So, you know, one further thought is I've been kind of comparing M0 disease of some of these other cancers, you know, as we sort of think about it. I was flashing on some of the debates that are going on about rituximab maintenance and low-grade lymphoma, believe it or not. But there, you know, you see a delay in progression-free survival. People, you know, it's been interesting over the last 10 years how people's views on that changed. In the beginning, a lot of people are saying, well, that's really valuable to the patient to know that they're not, that they appreciate not having disease progression. In a weird way, you know, this kind of reminds me of that because, again, the patients are asymptomatic. So what I really wonder about is everybody agrees what to do with PSA doubling times 3 or 6, where the numbers are just, you know, so amazing. But there must be more intermediate situations, and I bet a lot of those people don't get treated, and I don't know whether they should or not, or say should have it offered as an option.
Yeah, so this is really where I engage the patient in the conversation. I think it's important for them to understand what the goals of treatment are and what the expected side effects of therapy may be. And most of my patients in my practice, we often have a long relationship. We have a way of communicating effectively, and they usually get to a decision pretty quickly. They can say, you know, look, you're going to need more treatment. We could do the following and prevent the development of metastatic disease, and here are the potential downsides of doing so. Or we could monitor you and wait till you develop metastatic disease and treat you later, and here are the advantages and disadvantages of taking that approach. And when described in that way, most patients will readily form an opinion, and that's going to be a big driver behind the shared decision.
How often do they say, what would you do if it were you, doc?
I get that question a lot, and I have to say, earlier in my career, I had a harder time answering it. And I think that what the patient really means when they ask that question is like they're asking you to integrate everything you know about the biology of the cancer, the therapeutic options, and also your personal values. And so particularly for patients who you've developed long relationships with, I think it's a completely fair question, whereas I think earlier in my career, I had a different take on that same question.
I mean, it really gets at the heart of the integrity of the doctor-patient relationship because, you know, even if they don't ask the question, they expect it.
That's right.
They expect that you're doing for them what you would do for somebody in your family, but then you get into these situations where there really is no right answer. It really is dependent on what kind of person you are. Are you open to taking some risk? I mean, the great thing about these decisions is, you know, it seems like, yes, if you fall and have a fracture, okay, that's a problem, but a lot of times, you know, you could just stop the drug if you're really having a problem.
That's right.
So you mentioned the three agents and the three trials, and you actually reviewed these data, including the data that's just been presented on the third agent that is not yet approved. I'm guessing it will be approved based on what these data show, but certainly very interesting. In any event, can you talk about what we know right now about these three agents, these three trials, and, you know, given, quote, I hear this all the time, you know, the problems of inter-trial comparison, but yet that's what we have to deal with. What do you see when you compare the three?
Yeah, so there are limitations, of course, when comparing data between trials, but these trials are a very similar design, nearly identical patient populations based on their baseline characteristics, similar ascertainment of the primary study outcome, and all placebo-controlled. So for those reasons, we can probably do a little better job than usual of comparing between trials. So three potent antiandrogens. They each show a marked improvement in the primary endpoint of metastasis-free survival with hazard ratios in the sort of 0.3 to 0.4 range and improvements in time to metastasis or death of 22 to 24 months. So big effect in each case. And support from secondary endpoints in each of the trials. While the specific secondary endpoints varied between trials, there's a similar trend towards better overall survival in each of the trials of hazard ratios of 0.7 to 0.8. And as I mentioned earlier, longer follow-up will help really determine whether that turns out to be a statistically and clinically significant survival benefit. But support from other secondary endpoints, including, again, varied from trial to trial, but time to symptomatic progression, time to chemotherapy, time to progression on the subsequent agent in the case of the Spartan trial. So very strong support from the other outcomes. Ultimately, that led to regulatory approval of apalutamide and enzalutamide in that setting. And darolutamide, as you mentioned, is we presume would be approved based on similar strong data. There are differences in safety between the agents, and that's worth noting. And when you have placebo-controlled trials, you can really look between treatment and placebo and determine whether there is an excess of certain adverse events. And in the case of apalutamide and enzalutamide, a few things are worth noting as excess in the treatment arms, meaning appear to be causally related to apalutamide and enzalutamide. Those include fatigue, greater risk for falls and fractures, and then there's some differences between the agents, but hypertension, cardiovascular events, rash, fallout as side effects of one or other of those agents. Darolutamide, in contrast, based on the ARAMIS study, does appear to have a more favorable safety profile, again, being very careful to point out that these are not head-to-head comparisons. But with darolutamide, there is more fatigue, but does not appear to be any excess risk for falls, fractures, cognitive deterioration, or seizures. So there may be some meaningful tolerability advantages to darolutamide over the other agents.
Just out of curiosity, I know you participated in that study, but have you participated in any trials that were placebo-controlled where you were using either enzalutamide or apalutamide? And if so, do you think you could tell whether they were being treated?
In some cases, yes. I mean, there were patients who clearly developed problems or issues that when, you know, the unblinding occurred later, you weren't surprised to learn that they were on the investigational agent. In the ARAMIS study of darolutamide, I think it's much more difficult to tell. I was hard-pressed to put my nickel down and guess whether the patient was on placebo or darolutamide. So you can take that for what it's worth from a single investigator's impression.
So when you talk about, for example, excess falls, from an absolute number, are you talking about a couple percent or what's the difference?
The rates of falls and fractures were relatively low. Now realize these are not structured interviews. These were, you know, traditional adverse event reporting, which, you know, could underestimate the true occurrence of these events, as would be the case in any trial. The rates were in the mid-single digits, and they were approximately doubled in the case of apalutamide and enzalutamide. So you about doubled the rates of falls and fractures. Not all of those fractures were of major clinical significance, but it does give you this sense that there are these some adverse events occurring at greater frequency due to treatment with either apalutamide or enzalutamide. And that probably compounds some of the issues that we've been concerned about for a long time as side effects of chronic androgen deprivation therapy, which is these, you know, sort of foundational treatment of all of these patients.
Do you think there's a reliable way to objectively measure fatigue?
There are fatigue severity scales. Again, the fatigue data that I'm referring to in my recent comments here refers to fatigue as an adverse event. There are formal fatigue severity scales that can be used as sort of part of quality of life assessment, and that probably a more reliable way to really narrow down the issue of fatigue.
So if you had to estimate based on research as well as your own clinical experience, what would you say the risk is of somebody on either apalutamide or enzalutamide of some type of fatigue, fall, CNS kind of thing that'll be identifiable and, you know, sort of maybe a problem? Are you talking about like 1 out of 10 or half, or how often do you see it?
So I think that the way I advise patients is, and nearly all patients in my practice who are already on long-term ADT are going to report some fatigue if asked carefully about that issue. And you might argue that if you ask older men, many of them would report fatigue separate from any treatment for prostate cancer. But it's a fairly uniform symptom in my practice of men on long-term ADT for prostate cancer. And I advise my patients starting one of these agents that it is likely that they may experience more fatigue, although it's unlikely that that fatigue would prevent them from continuing treatment. You know, the rates of treatment discontinuation due to adverse events in any of these trials is quite low, single digits, although somewhat more likely than placebo with apalutamide or enzalutamide. And in my view, in clinical practice, separate from these trials, of the small percentage of patients who must discontinue treatment, fatigue is a driver behind that decision.
So I feel like I'm constantly putting together sort of poll or survey data. So I was just writing another one on prostate cancer, trying to figure out what to ask people. And I'll ask you, which is, how would you compare the efficacy of apalutamide, enzalutamide, and darolutamide in M0 disease in general? And one of the answers was going to be they're about the same. Is that the answer you would give, or do you think there's one or more than one that's better?
They are about the same. Of course, depends what you want to focus on. So in the case of apalutamide and enzalutamide, which are structurally similar, the available data for comparison between the trials is effectively indistinguishable. The hazard ratios for the primary endpoint of metastasis-free survival are 0.28 and 0.29, I believe, and the absolute improvement in metastasis-free survival is 24 and 22 months, respectively. And then if you look across other secondary endpoints that are shared, very, very similar data. For whatever reason, in the case of the Aramis study, the hazard ratio is closer to 0.4, so there's a somewhat larger hazard ratio. Whether that's a true difference between the agents or a vagary of the study design is hard to say. Turns out that the improvement in metastasis-free survival is 22 months in favor of darolutamide over placebo. So again, by that metric, nearly indistinguishable from the other drugs. And if you look at overall survival, you have apalutamide and darolutamide coming in with a hazard ratio of 0.7, enzalutamide with a hazard ratio of 0.8. I think with immature data, like as in the case of survival, it would be speculation to claim a meaningful difference in outcome. So I think to summarize, I'd say that these drugs are far more similar than different for efficacy.
So one of the things, you know, getting back to tolerability, I was kind of curious. I think I maybe missed that day in med school. What is the difference in terms of these exact agents? And what do we know at this point about, like, I guess, CNS penetration?
Darolutamide was designed not to penetrate the CNS and, you know, with the expectation that that might translate into a more favorable safety profile.
Wow.
And the non-clinical data supports that in that it has little or no CNS penetration in non-clinical models and also does not bind the GABA receptor, which is thought to be part of the mechanism of CNS side effects of the other agents.
One of the questions obviously is going to be if darolutamide is approved and you have equal access to each of those three agents and you decide you want to use one of them, how's an oncologist going to decide? How are you going to decide? Let's assume the economic, you know, burden is the same. Is it a coin flip? Or do you feel like the efficacy or the tolerability advantage is worth using darolutamide?
So with drugs with similar efficacy and some notable difference for side effects, I could envision reasonable people taking different positions about that. But certainly, I'll offer my comment, which is that certainly darolutamide does have some appeal here, particularly in a disease state of patients who are asymptomatic and where you anticipate a long period of drug exposure. So barring any additional information with longer follow-up to suggest meaningful differences in efficacy, I think darolutamide does become attractive based on its favorable safety profile.
Anything else that was presented at the ASCO G meeting? You already talked about the Aramis data. I think there's some updates presented. Anything interesting there? Any other M0 papers you saw that you want to comment on?
Yeah, sure. So one of the really nice features of the Spartan study of apalutamide was that the study included this endpoint of PFS2. Second progression-free survival, which refers to the time from study entry to progression on the subsequent agent. The prior notion, NMCRPC, was that, well, what's the point of intervening early? Because you could always give another drug, say abiraterone later, and the patients would catch up and do just as well by waiting. And so in an attempt to address that issue, the study was designed to include this exploratory endpoint of PFS2, and further, all patients at progression to metastatic disease could go on to subsequent, encouraged to go on to subsequent therapy. And to particularly encourage that, patients were provided abiraterone acetate on the study. And so at a very high rate, patients went on to subsequent treatment, and most of those patients received abiraterone. So although not exactly a sequencing trial, we do have some sequencing information from that study. And with the initial analysis, there was a clear benefit for PFS2, most succinctly, that meaning the patients initially got placebo did not catch up by getting later abiraterone or other agents. And with longer follow-up, that benefit in favor of early intervention with apalutamide was upheld with a hazard ratio of about 0.5.
You know, one alternative that we didn't talk about that's not approved in this situation is abiraterone. But, you know, I have seen, I think there was a paper that we found where they brought up the economic advantage of using abiraterone, give it with a meal, you give less dose. We talked about that at the meeting. You know, it sounds like the benefits of these agents are pretty profound, but would you go to this kind of strategy?
Not except under, say, special circumstances where for financial reasons it's the only therapy a patient could receive. So we just don't have the large randomized controlled trial of abiraterone in this setting. The duration of exposure is longer, so I do worry a little bit more about the safety issues. Prednisone twice a day is not an issue I worry about in patients with MCRPC or, for that matter, with high-risk non-hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. But in disease state like non-metastatic CRPC, I'd prefer a better tolerated agent, or I should say I become more concerned about the chronic toxicity of prednisone.
Anything new with that? I kind of had the impression that there was very little toxicity. Is there more than I thought? I mean, what about patients with diabetes, for example?
Yeah, I would characterize all the agents we're discussing as well tolerated. But, you know, once you have them in your clinic and you're routinely treating patients, you begin to appreciate some of the issues that come into play. So the specific issues around abiraterone, it's a minority of patients, but they're worth mentioning, are patients with poorly controlled diabetes where the addition of some prednisone could be a meaningful issue. Certainly treated plenty of patients with diabetes with abiraterone, acetate, and prednisone with no problem, but patients with brittle diabetes would be a special situation. And the other one that's really worth mentioning, particularly to the sort of general medical oncologist, is this issue of fluid retention. The original studies of abiraterone acetate excluded patients with congestive heart failure, low ejection fraction. And it's worth noting because you can't unmask sort of subclinical or mild congestive heart failure in patients if you're not careful. So particularly as you treat older, frailer patients, it's worth taking a history about their cardiac history, understanding whether they've had prior myocardial infarctions, look to the record to see if they've had an ejection fraction measurement. And I have seen some cases where that wasn't attended to, and then patients end up with problems that could have been prevented.
Just to be clear now, you're talking about the corticosteroid, not the abiraterone, correct?
No, it's really the abiraterone.
Abiraterone?
So as mechanistically part of it, as a steroid biosynthesis inhibitor,
sure,
a well-established side effect of that is fluid retention, which in well-selected patients is really unlikely to be an issue, but is an issue that is worth mentioning because all of the original pivotal studies of abiraterone excluded patients with congestive heart failure.
So it has a mineralocorticoid effect, I guess.
Exactly.
But anyhow, let's talk about hormone-sensitive metastatic disease because that was the second big topic that we talked about. And we also saw some new data. It was interesting. It was a good ASCO GU. You don't always see big phase 3 trials coming out there, but we have some good ones this year. So again, where were we? This started a few years ago, I remember, with the charted docetaxel thing and then moved on. So where were we when you got to San Francisco and where were we when we left?
Sure. So I think prior to ASCO GU 2019, we look at this, you know, poor prognosis, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease where, you know, I think the new standard of care is either docetaxel or abiraterone, acetate plus prednisone. You could compare and contrast those two options and debate that. But certainly, I think there's a clear acknowledgement by all of us that we should intensify systemic treatment for patients with poor prognosis, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, meaning it's not just androgen deprivation therapy alone anymore. And that's very different than the approach of just a few years ago, or for many years, where the mainstay of treatment was ADT alone, and all subsequent therapy only followed after development of castration-resistant disease. I think there are two big pieces of new information. One is with longer follow-up from the Latitude trial of abiraterone acetate plus prednisone, this dramatic improvement in overall survival is upheld with a hazard ratio of about 0.7 and an absolute improvement in overall survival of almost a year and a half from about 3 years in the control group of ADT alone to almost 4.5 years in the intervention group that included early abiraterone acetate plus prednisone. So that's important. The other new data that was presented was the ARCHES data, randomized controlled trial of patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer randomized to either enzalutamide or placebo, all patients, of course, receiving androgen deprivation therapy. And there you see a marked improvement in time to progression without mature survival data. So there's a big effect on these intermediate endpoints of time to progression, time to PSA progression, PSA response, all of those things. So I guess, not surprising data given what we already knew about abiraterone acetate and prednisone, as well as the similarity of efficacy between Enza and Abi. So it looks like there would now be a third choice in this hormone-sensitive metastatic setting, and I think that's a good thing for patients.
So trying again, to now that you have a new data set and another agent in this space, can you kind of contrast, first of all, enzalutamide to abiraterone in terms of the efficacy findings with all the caveats of indirect comparison, about the same or one better than the other?
So referring first to metastatic castration-resistant disease, I'd say it's about the same. Again, that's been the subject of, you know, debates in open session and all of that, and reasonable people could take either position. But basically, very similar data with marked improvements in RPFS and improvements in overall survival in both the pre- and post-chemotherapy setting in castration-resistant disease. So if you set that data aside, you'd say that the abiraterone data is better based on the Latitude trial than in the Arches trial, partly because it's more mature and probably because the Latitude study did a very special thing, which was included patients at particularly high risk for progression. So if you're likely to do poorly with standard therapy, intensification of treatment is more likely to have a favorable effect. The Arches study was more heterogeneous. About a third of the patients did not have de novo metastatic disease. About a third of the patients had so-called low-volume metastatic disease. Some of the patients in each of the arms received docetaxel. That was an accommodation based on prior evidence of a survival benefit for docetaxel. So a more heterogeneous trial that included more patients at lower risk than in Latitude, as well as some patients who received docetaxel.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm naive, but kind of like the first thing I'm looking at is hazard rate. Mm-hmm. And not to mention, we shouldn't be comparing anyhow. But so Enza was 0.39. Is that right?
Yep.
And then what about Abby?
In Latitude?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't recall. But the primary endpoint, I think it was closer to 0.5. But in Latitude, the primary outcome was overall survival. So they kind of flipped the primary and secondary endpoints. And so shorter follow-up in Arches, different primary study endpoint. So the key way I think about this is my prior conclusion coming into the results in the hormone-sensitive metastatic disease setting is that these are two very similar agents which have very well-established clinical benefits in castration-resistant disease. So for example, if you were a favored abiraterone, you might make the argument that Arches is inferior because it doesn't have a survival benefit, but I would submit that's a bit unfair because it has shorter follow-up, so we wouldn't know whether to have a survival benefit yet, and the survival benefit's already well established in castration-resistant disease.
So I guess then it sounds like it'd be the same kind of decision in terms of between abiraterone and enzalutamide as it would be in the castrate-resistant situation based on
other factors.
Other factors. But the big question that's already been out there for a while is docetaxel versus one of those two. So, and then where the other issue is going to be, are we going to end up landing on both?
Both are distinctly possible. So the first question, you know, is it docetaxel or Abi? We'll phrase the question that way. Patient and physician acceptance of Abi Pred is just easier than for chemotherapy, certainly in my practice or in United States-based practice where you have options and there's reimbursement for those drugs. There are countries in the world where, you know, abiraterone in hormone-sensitive metastatic disease is not an option. It's not reimbursed. So that's a different conversation there.
In terms of duration, though, it's indefinite until progression or toxicity?
So, yeah, in Latitude and in one of the Stampede RMG, the Abi was continued until progression. But recognizing that in Latitude, where you have a high-risk patient population, that expected time to progression is not all that long in either the control group or even with, you know, the improved outcome with Abi. But it is substantially longer, you know, sort of 1.5 to 2 year range than you'd expect of treatment duration than you get with docetaxel, which would be 6 months of therapy. So the advantage of docetaxel might arguably you're sort of over and done earlier, but it's at a greater cost of side effects.
Yeah. When I first heard people say that there were patients who preferred docetaxel, I was like, really? And then people would say, yeah, there are people who just want to get it over with. I'm like, really? Docetaxel? I don't know. I mean, do you tell me, really? Do you see patients like that?
I saw one today whose decision was really financial because he had very poor outpatient prescription coverage.
Yeah, well, that's a different story.
He made the financial calculation, although I do have to say, seeing him today in cycle four, I did wonder whether he regretted that decision.
Wow, really?
Yeah, well, you know, as to your point, I mean, docetaxel has side effects.
Well, so this patient took the docetaxel for financial reasons and is having toxicity.
Well, I mean, expected toxicity.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, the usual, docetaxel.
Nothing unusual, just the expected side effects.
Wow.
But the second question you posed is, should we be giving them both? And by both, I would take that to mean sequential therapy. So docetaxel followed by the other one or potentially in combination. But those are questions we're going to sort of getting a little bit of information, even from ARCHES, where some of the patients received docetaxel. But it'll be formally addressed in the ARASENS trial, which is a randomized controlled trial of ADT docetaxel plus or minus darolutamide, the same drug studied in ARAMIS, with the primary outcome of overall survival. So when the data for that study is fully accrued and when the data mature, we'll have a clear information about whether there is a benefit to adding potent anti-androgen to docetaxel in the hormone-sensitive metastatic setting.
One other thing about treatment of hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, we actually put it in the poll in the meeting, and not only did some of the people in the audience, but some of the faculty said they do this on occasion, which is to start androgen deprivation and see how the patient does. And then, quote, if the response isn't what they're looking for, then to add in docetaxel or one of the other agents. What do you think about that kind of strategy?
So it's not a strategy that I routinely use, but it is a strategy that I occasionally use. So it's really the setting for where I've used that is typically in a patient who's reluctant to accept intensification of therapy. I think that was more of an issue before we had evidence that, you know, oral hormonal agents can improve progression-free and overall survival. But when it was a docetaxel-only decision, there were patients who say, you know, doc, how about if I talk about this when I get back from my vacation? And then, of course, you're going to measure, can we look at my PSA before we decide? And there are patients who, and I would speculate, we don't have the evidence about this, that if you were to do such a trial and segregate patients according to their response to initial ADT, that the benefit is primarily going to be in patients with suboptimal PSA responses for intensification of therapy.
So if they had the randomization, it was after 4 months of ADT.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who weren't responding were randomized.
Yeah, I would imagine that's where much of the benefit resides, but that is speculation. So I do not adopt that approach routinely, but there are cases where either I'm on the fence or the patient's unwilling to accept intensification of therapy where I would consider that as a very reasoned approach to management.
So I want to kind of run through a few other issues that we talked about in the symposium and just sort of get your take. If there's anything either at ASCO GU or stuff that maybe you know about that I don't that you want to comment on, I'm just going to fire out a few issues that came up and hear what you have to say about them. So one that has been coming up quite a bit now in the last couple of years, I actually started hearing it in things like pancreatic cancer, but also is the issue of BRCA testing and PARP inhibitors. And we talked about that at some length, but can you just talk a little bit about where we stand today in terms of that strategy, what we know about the biology of prostate cancer related to germline mutations and somatic mutations?
Yeah, so in recent years, there's been a few surprises in the field. The first is that BRCA mutations and other mutations in DNA repair genes are relatively common, particularly in men with metastatic prostate cancer. From one published study, for example, about 12% of men with metastatic prostate cancer had mutations in a DNA repair gene, the most common being BRCA1, 2, and ATM. And then other genetic sequencing data from tumors of patients with castration-resistant prostate cancer identify that as a relatively common mutation, with about 20% of patients having such mutations, and many of those being somatic. So that was very compelling, and that and other information led to evaluation of PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer. And the first such study, the TOPARP study, reported a response rate of about 1 in 3 patients with mCRPC and disease progression after multiple lines of therapy having a response to olaparib in this case, and that the presence of a mutation in a DNA repair gene was strongly predictive of response to olaparib. It was almost perfectly predictive of response. And so that's sort of a new finding in the field and, you know, heralded kind of precision medicine coming to prostate cancer, and a lot of enthusiasm for a further evaluation of olaparib and other PARP inhibitors in this disease.
Have you had any patient yourself who received a PARP inhibitor, had a clear-cut objective response?
Absolutely. So we do a few things now based on the information I just described. One is we offer germline testing to all of our patients with metastatic prostate cancer and to selected patients with high-risk disease, particularly those with a strong family history or young age at diagnosis. Our rates of positivity for BRCA and other DNA repair mutations is similar to the data I just cited, at about in the sort of the 10 to 15% range in our Boston practice. And we also do next generation sequencing of tumors in patients who are sort of running out of options with mCRPC. For all such patients, we preferentially enroll them in clinical trials of PARP inhibitors when available. And if not available, we have treated patients off-label with olaparib.
And what about patients with somatic mutations only? What kind of mutations will get you inclined? Would you actually use a PARP inhibitor, or have you used a PARP inhibitor?
Well, one of the nice things about germline genetic testing, of course, it's binary. You were born with it or not. And so you can sort of find out at any course along the patient's trajectory as to whether or not they have a germline mutation. And then you've identified them early, and then you can prioritize either enrollment in a trial or at a suitable time in their treatment, treatment with olaparib or another PARP inhibitor. But once we identify a patient like that, again, if they can't enroll in a clinical trial, we'd usually not treat them until they've had at least Abi or Enza, and often docetaxel, and then only then consider a PARP inhibitor. And that comes from really the data from the TOOLPARP study. And we have certainly, in the context of trials as well as in off-label treatment, seen dramatic responses in some cases to PARP inhibition.
What do we know about patients with prostate cancer, let's say BRCA germline mutations, in response to platinum agents?
There's at least some anecdotal evidence that platinum is active in that setting. What we don't have is comparative information about, you know, platinum versus PARP inhibition or, you know, sequential treatment with these agents. So we have a long way to go. We have a lot to learn from our ovarian cancer colleagues.
So from a practical perspective, is it now standard of care for a patient, at least with castrate-resistant metastatic disease, if not earlier? I mean, to have some type of testing, and what would you say is the minimum? I mean, BRCA germline?
Yeah, so I think in my practice, we're looking at two big things. One is, you know, a reason to consider a PARP inhibitor or platinum, which would be, you know, BRCA mutation or other DNA repair defect. So germline testing gets you some of that. Next generation sequence gets you the rest of the way. The other thing we're looking for is mismatch repair, which is quite uncommon, sort of maybe 1% to 3% range, depending on which series you look at. You get that from next-generation sequencing. You can also get that from immunohistochemistry if you look at loss of mismatch repair proteins. And we have treated patients with pembrolizumab in either of those categories of that rare 1% to 3% of patients with either MSI-high or DMMR.
That was actually the next thing I was going to ask you about, and you answered my question in terms of that. In terms of the use of checkpoint inhibitors, I'm just kind of curious, have you had any patients with MSI-high disease that got checkpoint inhibitors?
So we have. It's, you know, our rate of positivity falls in that very low range of kind of the 1% to 3% range. But I'd say it's a humbling part of what we do, you know, because a big question is, you know, what is the correct biomarker? And we've seen all kinds of unusual iterations of this. For example, a patient who has DMMR, meaning has immunohistochemical evidence of loss of mismatch repair proteins, who had a dramatic and ongoing durable response to pembrolizumab, but who on Foundation 1 testing, next generation sequencing testing, had no mutations in mismatch repair proteins and was MSI normal. So there can be this discordance of testing. I mean, I think that's been well described in other fields. So we don't know what the ideal biomarker or set of biomarkers should be. But I would say it's certainly worth looking for, because now we have at least two shots on goal in patients who are running out of other options. One is there a reason to consider treatment with platinum or a PARP inhibitor? And then at an even lower rate, is there a reason to consider treatment with pembrolizumab?
So I don't know, that might have slipped by me in some of these other cancers. You're saying there's like a false negative rate with NGS in terms of MSI?
No, I think that patient why he was MSI normal. I think the assumption, we haven't done other testing yet, but is that he's methylated those proteins and lost expression.
Oh, so you don't have IHC on that patient?
We do have IHC on a responding patient who has loss of mismatch repair protein expression.
So his NGS was false negative, right?
Yeah, fair enough, yeah. So, and you know, I think that's been described in other cancers as well, so not a criticism of that specific test. It's just a recognition that there can be discordance.
I've been trying to figure that out. I actually hadn't heard that. I think that's really interesting.
And it's also critical when we think about the results of trials that look at populations and say, well, they didn't have mismatch repair by this assay or however they characterize it, particularly when there's a very low rate of responders, because you then wonder whether that biomarker was, in that case, a false positive, or that there's something different about the biology that we don't yet understand.
I know that there was this great paper in JAMA Oncology, and I showed it to Tony Saab at ASCO GI, actually, and he was like, oh, no, they used the old technique or something, but they looked at people who were MSI high, I think it was multiple cancers, who did not respond to a checkpoint inhibitor. And they found a lot of them on central testing were MSI normal.
Right.
And Tony was like, oh, no, they used the old assay or whatever. He didn't think it was that. I was like, wow, it's scary to think you get that wrong.
It's not as clear as it might seem.
Yeah, I mean, he and one other doc presented me cases of people who were referred to them for hospice who had not had MSI testing, were MSI positive, and now doing great. Hospice. I hear that, you know, a lot. I'm sure it's rare, but that it ever occurs is amazing. So one other new thing that sounds pretty encouraging, radio-labeled PSMA. What's the deal there? Sounds good. I know Oliver Sartor was talking about it. I know he's all excited about it. What's your take on it?
Yeah, so I'm glad to see that that approach is now subject to a phase 3 trial. Lutetium PSMA in a randomized phase 2 trial showed promising activity. So I think there's something real there. Whether that will translate into a true clinical meaning benefit ultimately, of course, is the subject of the phase 3 trial, and that's really the way that field will be moved forward. I believe PSMA is a good target. Whether that's the right warhead with lutetium or it should be something else remains to be determined, but there certainly that's one example of a variety of PSMA approaches that are being evaluated now, and so this is a very good time in the field, and it's attractive for patients in many ways because, you know, the dilemma of the two prior therapies we talked about is they really, you know, may benefit a relatively modest or small minority of patients in the case of DNA repair or mismatch repair. But here you're looking at, you know, the vast majority of patients, nearly something like 90% of patients are going to be PSMA positive, depending on how you would define that.
I was trying to think of other examples of radio-labeled therapy. So I guess you have that in thyroid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that, well, they have it in low-grade lymphoma, although they never use it. I mean, do you see it? I work with you a long time, and I'm kind of reading a little skepticism. Am I hearing that from you?
Well, I think, you know, the longer I've done this, the more careful I've been about interpreting phase 2 data. And I look at the Australian data of lutetium PSMA is saying, you know, there's certainly enough signal there to say that this should be moved forward. I think I may have incorrectly described it as randomized phase 2, but the phase 2 data from Australia is compelling, and it moved the field forward because a lot of the earlier experience with this PSMA-targeted therapy had been more or less small case series or almost anecdotal data from Germany. So this was a prospective clinical trial that I think nicely defined the attributes of that product, and you do see responses in a substantial proportion of patients who had seen a variety of other therapies. So I think there's enough signal there to say this is something that should be moved forward to phase 3. But I would say, you know, as is the case for most phase 3 studies, it is far from certain that that observed clinical benefit in phase 2 will be sufficient to translate into a large enough clinical benefit in phase 3 to warrant routine use of the drug or approval of the drug.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, when you say, I guess, patients have responded, have they had imaging responses or just PSA?
Both. And I think one of the caveats, and not everyone may agree with this, but it sort of depends on what method of imaging you use. I think some of these dramatic anecdotes that you're seeing, and I think saw some of at this meeting, are if you use a PSMA PET scan as a pre-post assessment of a PSMA-targeted therapy, I would submit that it is possible, possible that you may be overestimating the true clinical benefit of your therapy. And I'd be much more interested to see the results of sort of conventional intermediate endpoints like conventional imaging, PSA, CTCs, those sorts of things. And by those metrics, there certainly are responses in that Australian study that I referred to at a high enough proportion that you'd say, yeah, that is really something that should be moved to phase three.
I don't know. I've got to say, you know, like kind of was thinking about ibrutinib versus chlorambucil for CLL. They did a phase three trial on that. And I'm like, really? Why? Why do they have to do a phase three trial on that? You gave ibrutinib. You see what happens. Why do you have to have a randomized trial? I kind of wonder. I mean, I don't know. Do you think if you have a novel agent like this that has relatively little toxicity, I mean, it may not be true of this agent, but, you know, for example, if two-thirds of the patients, the disease clearly got better and stayed better for a couple of years, which is kind of like what happens with ibrutinib, for example. I mean, do you really need a phase three trial?
It's my view that you do not uniformly need phase threes. And it's, for example, why pembrolizumab is approved in a variety of cancers.
Right, that's true.
And why is that? Because you have a marker that can reliably, but not perfectly, predict response. And those responses are deep and durable, right? So this is a dramatic, dramatic outcome. I think we have to be a lot more circumspect when you're looking at, in the case of PSMA, more or less unselected patient population, because the vast majority of patients are PSMA positive, and you have in middle level of response, and at least to date, no indication that those responses are uniformly durable. So that's where my caution is coming in, not only about this agent, but you know, any agent with similar kind of clinical data.
So final question, anything else that happened at ASCO GU, any papers, any posters, anything you were involved with that you might want to comment on that you think would be of interest?
Yeah, so let me comment on the work of others. So I think that we talked a little bit about immunotherapy for prostate cancer and pembro in patients who are MSI high or have other evidence of mismatch repair. So there's a lot of interest in trying to expand that therapy to a broader group of patients, and a couple of approaches were discussed at the meeting. One was ipi-nivo combination, and another was olaparib combination. And, you know, I think the takeaway from both of those trials is we still have a long way to go. The ipi-nivo combination, for example, had a somewhat higher rate of response than you'd expect to see in patients who weren't otherwise selected for immunotherapy. But that combination comes with a lot of side effects, and the response proportion, although better than what you might expect, was still really quite low. So I think we still have a long way to go to broaden the number of patients who can benefit from immunotherapy.
In that regard, because I kind of flashed on the fact that breast cancer was sort of in a similar situation for a long time, never had anything to talk about in terms of checkpoint inhibitors. And then they tried it combined with chemo, which of course is standard of care with lung cancer, and now it's approved in triple-negative breast cancer. What about checkpoint inhibitors plus docetaxel or chemotherapy?
Yeah, I think that or similar approaches may work, but I think the key part of success of such approaches are going to be to defining a specific population most likely to benefit. I think if we take this broad approach of all mCRPC is the same and we can just look at different combinations, that's an approach that is less likely to succeed.
Just out of curiosity, what do you see in terms of PD-L1 levels, PD-L1 levels and tumor mutation burden in prostate cancer?
Those are generally normal, and that was seen in the ipi-nivo study. So, you know, the proportion of patients with a high tumor mutational burden was low. And so these are not common alterations that we see in prostate cancer.
CAR-T in prostate cancer, anybody looking at it? Is there PSMA CAR-T maybe?
That is the approach that's being taken.
Really?
And I can't speak with any authority on those issues other than to say that there are a number of different studies ongoing of CAR-T in prostate cancer, too early to say whether that approach will benefit patients.
Well, that's really interesting. Any patients been treated yet?
There have been patients treated, yet, very early.
Any responses?
Not meaningful clinical responses that I'm aware of.
Interesting.
I haven't seen that data presented.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio spinoff program of a satellite CME symposium on prostate cancer held at the 2019 Genitourinary Cancer Symposium in San Francisco.